Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. This podcast is my last post of 2021, so I thought I'd take a look back over the year, highlight some of the articles and other posts that I'd made that if you haven't had a chance to check out, maybe you should go back and check out, and just kind of reflect on some of my takeaways from the year. Just a good time to look back on things before we move forward into the new year. So the year started relatively slowly for me as far as kind of content and topic ideas. And then in March, there was a story about a mountain biker getting stabbed by a hiker. And this got me thinking about some things that I'd been getting more into with my own self-defense over the previous, probably been about, 8 months or so at that time. And so I've been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for, at this point, a little over 9 years. And while I definitely love a lot of different aspects of it, the sport and just the camaraderie and the technical, mental, physical challenge that it provides, all these things are great. But, one of the most important aspects for me is self-defense. It was one of the main reasons that I got into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as opposed to some other martial arts because of its proven effectiveness in a self-defense situation. And so as expanding my self-defense mindset and skills led me into some other areas that I hadn't really thought about before, but I realized played a huge role, in what happened with that biker and hiker that day, and that they were things that a lot of riders just don't really think about, and that there's a whole world of things that we need to be thinking about as mountain bikers beyond just, riding our bikes and the latest equipment and, some fitness stuff to help us ride faster. There's other things to consider both on a daily basis and when you're on the trail. So I did a post, covering some of those things, and I got some good feedback on that, and I realized some other people were interested in this. And so I did a series of posts covering some different topics in this area. And one of them was on tourniquets for mountain biking. One was on medical training for mountain biking. And just to, touch on that, we participate in a dangerous sport. One of the posts that I made over the last year that I'll touch on here later was on a injury study. And you see from the numbers that mountain biking is a relatively dangerous sport compared to other activities. And so it makes sense that we should think about being prepared to help ourselves or other people should something happen and someone get hurt. And so knowing some basic things like CPR, having some basic tools like a tourniquet. And, again, if you think about it, we carry things to repair flats because we know that we can have something punch a hole in our tire, right? But our skin is much easier to punch a hole in than a tire. And so if we acknowledge that there's things on the trail that can punch a hole through a rubber tire, then we need to also acknowledge that we could be the recipient of that as well and end up in a situation where we've got some severe bleeding. And being able to control that bleeding until people can get to help or help can get to them is a big part of, civilian medical training, because you're not really trying to become a trauma doctor, right? That's not what your goal is. Your goal is to just be able to help stabilize the situation long enough for the real help to get there. And one of the things that you can't wait on is bleeding. If someone's bleeding out, that's not gonna wait for the medical professionals to get there or you to get them to the medical professionals. You're gonna have to take care of that very quickly. And that's where things like tourniquet and having some sort of compression bandage or a quick clot or something that can help if you get a nasty cut or gash or, God forbid, nick an artery and have to deal with that. And so, it's something, again, that we don't talk about enough, I think, is mountain bikers Because we love to just focus on the positive sides of mountain biking, which are great, but there are some potential bad things that can happen, and we need to be thinking about those and be prepared for those. So, you know, like I said, like having basic CPR skills, having some tools, understanding the march algorithm, which again, I went over in the post on the medical training, but just there is a checklist that you want to go through if, you know, you or someone is gone through a traumatic injury situation, and just check these boxes and make sure that these things are taken care of in a particular order, right? So M is massive bleeding. That's first and foremost. If someone's bleeding, you have to take care of that, right? After you've checked and taken care of that, airway, are they breathing? Are you able to breathe easy? Do you have to, you know, check, see if there's something obstructing the airway or something, you know? And so anyways, but there's, like I said, go check out that post or just Google March algorithm, and you'll get an idea or see, you know, a bunch of information that can help you understand that. But again, basic stuff, you're not trying to become an emergency room doctor. You're just trying to have the knowledge and the tools that you would need to be helpful in a situation where someone was hurt. And it could be you, it could be someone that you're riding with, it could be someone that you come across on the trail, right? So you could be someone that you come across in a car wreck on the way to the trail. So again, this is a skill that I think that if you want to be a helpful citizen, it's something that is not super hard to do. And it doesn't require a giant investment to have a few pieces of equipment that can help with that. So that kind of led to another topic that I was covering about everyday carry, or what's known as, you know, commonly called EDC in some circles. And so I was talking about the concept of the MTB warrior, and the warrior being the one that can bring the others back, right? Like there's this quote that, you know, some people credit to Herodotus, some people say was, you know, not him. Anyways, I don't care. It's cool to think that it did come from an ancient Greek who talked about, you know, out of every 100 men in battle, like 80 shouldn't be there, you know, 10 are, you know, just targets. You know, you've got, you know, a small handful that are, you know, fighters, but one out of every 100 is the true warrior. And the thing that I liked about it that it ends with, it's not like the warrior kills the most people. The warrior is the one who brings the others back, right? That was the idea. Like the warrior is the one who can bring the others back. And that's really what the concept of, you know, the MTB warrior is it's, you know, could you help bring the others back if something happened? And if you, and most people, unfortunately, couldn't. Most people would be a liability in a situation like that. And, or, you know, in some sort of situation that requires, like, you know, quick action with, you know, someone bleeding or, you know, these things. And so, anyways, but to be able to do that, one, you need the knowledge and the skills, but you also need some tools. There's some basic tools that will help you be much more useful to yourself and other people on an average, you know, daily basis. And so one, just things that you should have on you at all times, just in everyday life. And also when you're riding, like one, something to cut with, okay, which is generally a knife, right? It could be a knife on your multi-tool, right? But just having something that you can cut with, something that you can make fire with. The easiest thing there would be a lighter, but it could be some waterproof matches or, you know, a ferro rod or something if you want to get real, making fire real difficult. But, you know, just carrying a lighter, something to make light with. So again, a simple flashlight or a headlamp or, you know, something like that. And then finally, something to tie up things. If you needed to tie something down, if you needed to rig up something that you could carry something. So the easiest thing there is cordage. So having some paracord, it doesn't take up much space and can be very useful. Once you know a few simple knots, like, you know, paracord becomes extremely useful as a tool. And so, but these four things are things that you should have on you at all times, right? If you leave the house, you should have something that fits into these four categories. And that includes going on the trail. And so, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily have a flashlight or a headlamp that they go out with. So if you end up on the trail after dark for some reason, like, you know, all of a sudden you wish you had some way to make light. But you know, that's just like a really simple example, but there are other things, because I had like some basic stuff, and then I had like an expanded video that I did talking about, you know, some of the medical things and some of the survival things that you want. You know, I already touched on a tourniquet, but the other thing is something to signal with, right? So either a whistle or a signal mirror, and something to make shelter with, or at least like cover up. So like a solar blanket would be something. But you know, when you go out on a ride, especially if you are going into the backcountry or away from civilization at all, you need to be prepared to possibly spend the night. Like, what if something happened and you weren't able to make it back and you had to spend the night, right? Like, that shouldn't turn into a survival situation. That should be, you know, maybe a little uncomfortable, but it shouldn't be a potential survival situation. But it can turn into that if you don't have a few basic tools. And so, which actually kind of leads me to another thing that I was touching on with some of my posts, which is how to apply some of these self-defense and preparedness, really. Like, that's what it is. Like, are you prepared? How many situations are you prepared for? And like, maybe you don't need to be prepared for snakes on a plane. Okay, like, not like being prepared for everything isn't necessarily possible, but you should be prepared for some basic things that you might run into on a, you know, throughout your life at some point. Okay, and so that's what the idea is being prepared. And that can, you know, be prepared to defend yourself and others. It can be prepared to administer medical help if necessary. It can be prepared to survive on the trail, or, you know, out in the backcountry if you had to, because some mechanical problem or you got hurt or something, whatever, right? And so I interviewed a few people that I'd been taking classes and learning from in this area on some podcasts that, again, I think are good to check out if you haven't already. So two of the people were in the self-defense arena. So Tony Blauer, who's the guy behind the spear system, you know, he's got a really good, you know, we talk mainly about like fear and how like the mental side of managing fear. Cause one of the big insights that I had was that the same mindset that is required to survive a self-defense situation is the same mindset that you need to, you know, be a good mountain biker and be successful at life, right? Like the basic principles that you apply of not being paralyzed by fear and being able to make a decision and be decisive, but that comes from also preparation before that point, right? Like all these things come together, but it's a hyper-compressed situation in a self-defense situation, but it gets expanded out over the course of people's lives. And you have people who live these quiet, you know, lives of quiet desperation because they let the fear and the same things that would lock them up in a self-defense situation and go against them also are locking them up and making it harder for them to be successful at life. And so that's one of the things that Tony ties into his system, is understanding that mental aspect. And so I really encourage you to check him out with that. But we talked about that. We dove into that. Also talked to Rodney King, who is a self-defense specialist. I did a knife defense course with him. And so that was really interesting, because again, doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you learn how to grapple, but you don't often learn how to deal with a weapon. And so knowing how to deal with a knife is one of those things that, again, it doesn't get touched on in a lot of classes. And so I wanted to expand that, again, just wanting to expand my own self-defense knowledge. That was one of those areas. And so doing some research, he was a well-respected and recommended member of the self-defense community in that area. And so I actually was able to get him to come on for an interview as well. And again, a lot of what we talk about is mental, and things like just being situationally aware, right? Like, so this kind of goes back to some of the lessons learned from the rider getting stabbed by a hiker. And, you know, there was a huge lack of situational awareness on everybody's part in that situation, right? Not absolving anyone. But again, if you haven't checked out that story, or forget, like, you know, again, the last story I heard was that you had a rider who refused to concede the right of way to some hikers and pushed the situation and ended up falling over onto one of the hikers And then that hiker then pulled out a knife and started stabbing him, claiming that he thought this dude was attacking him. And so you can see, like, there's really no innocent, truly innocent party in that situation. Not excusing, there's no excuse to stab someone, right? But you should have been able to tell that this guy is getting very agitated before you started trying to push the issue and ride past them, you know, going uphill and pushing it, you know, whatever the situation was, right? And so, and conversely, people in that guy's group, like that guy who ended up stabbing the rider, same thing. Like, he should have recognized, man, this guy's just got a problem. He's not going to concede this, even though I technically have the right of way. I just need to take a deep breath and let it go. People in his group could have recognized that and stepped in. But all of a sudden, you got a mountain biker laying on top of a hiker getting stabbed, right? And that's not how it happens. It doesn't just all of a sudden happen. There's a whole lead up to these things. And there's so many ways for you to avoid ever having to use any sort of self-defense skills or anything like that through basic situational awareness. And so, again, that was a lot of what we talked about and some of the mental aspects of that. And then finally, I was able to talk to Kevin Estella, who is, he works with Fieldcraft Survival. He is a, you know, survival expert. One of these guys that could, you know, go out into the backcountry with a Swiss Army knife and, you know, come back in 6 months and having built a cabin and, you know, just it's he's a really impressive individual with his skills and also his teaching ability. And so I had a chance to do a class with him, and he wrote a book called 101 Skills You Need to Survive in the Woods. And so I had him come on, and we talked about some of the things that mountain bikers need to be more aware of. And when it comes to this, because again, we're going out into the backcountry, we're going out into the desert, we're going out into the mountains. Like, so we are going off the beaten path in a lot of cases. And so being able to take care of yourself if something goes wrong, and I've already touched on this already, but this was, you know, pretty much the topic of conversation. And so I did ask him at the end, like, you know, what are some patterns that you've noticed, you know, because obviously through his study, he's read about and learned about far more good and bad situations that have resulted and you know, been able to glean some lessons from that. And so he was able to share his insights in that. So I'd highly recommend you check out that interview to learn more about what he recommends us as riders, you know, pay more attention to some of the basics, the skills that we should have and the tools that we should have and things that we should try to, you know, do to help improve our survivability if something went wrong. And so, but again, so that was a I guess, kind of a turning point for me in general in realizing that my interest in helping riders improve has gone way beyond just kettlebells and strength training. And really just even like the you know, the skills of riding a bike, and that there's a whole lot of other things that go into being a successful rider and a successful human being than just those things. And so, so, you know, I guess one of the themes of this last year was kind of fleshing out some of these ideas and things that I think are going to form a big part of the direction for MTB Strength Training Systems and myself moving forward that we're going to be focusing on, as opposed to, you know, I've never really been hyper focused on trying to appeal to the racing crowd. You know, even though I've worked with several high level World Cup level riders, you know, I've never really been into racing. You know, I understand why people do it, but I also think that there's a lot more to mountain biking than just racing. And I've always been more interested in that aspect and that side of things, especially as I've gotten older, like gotten into the 40 plus crowd and just realizing that, man, there's a whole lot else to life and to writing than just that. And so, so anyways, getting into some of these other things is going to be a focus for me. But all right, so back on to some of the things that I took away from the last year. So kind of moving on from the, what, like I said, you had that incident with the rider getting stabbed by a hiker And then that just kind of led to a whole lot of other posts and things throughout the last year that was kind of in that ballpark of topics. Another post that I did was on the science of coaching and learning. And this was, every once in a while, I will read a book that really makes me question how I've been coaching people. And it's this was one of those books where you go, dang it, I've been doing some things not as good as I could have, and I need to make some adjustments, which is never a great feeling, but it's good to see the results from that and be able to move in a more positive direction with things. And so with the, again, I highly encourage you to go check out the post, because I went into, it was a podcast that I did, and I went into the book and the science behind all this stuff in a lot more detail. But the take-home message from it was that there is science behind coaching people, and there is science behind the best ways to use coaching cues and what types of coaching cues are most effective. And so we're starting to be able to lean a little bit more on the science than just the art, right? Like that's the thing with coaching. It's always going to be an art and a science. It's going to be very tough to turn it into a hard science where you could just program a robot to do the exact same thing that a good coach can do. But we should always be striving to try to figure out how we can use science as best as possible to drive our decisions and lean less on the art. And coaching cues is one of these things, right? How the words that you use to try to get somebody to do something has a big impact on how they do it, right? You know, like, well, duh, James. But some are better and easier for people to process than others. And so it's not about like your favorite pet coaching cue, right? It's about what is most effective and is going to help people get the best results in the shortest amount of time. And one of the main findings is that having some sort of external based coaching cue, so getting people to think about something outside of their body, like moving something in some sort of direction, as opposed to having them have an internal focus and thinking about specific joints and muscles within their body. So a good example for this is when you're coming up out of the bottom of a deadlift, you know, a hinge type movement, swing. You know, one of the most popular coaching cues is to squeeze your glutes and get tall, or squeeze your glutes and come up, or, you know, whatever. But I mean, I've said squeeze your glutes thousands and thousands and thousands of times to coaching clients and on videos. And so I am as guilty as anyone of using what is really an internally focused coaching cue, like your glutes. Telling someone to squeeze their glutes is an internal coaching cue, right? An external coaching cue would be to tell them, like, you know, imagine you've got on a belt, right? So you want to push your belt buckle back over your feet, drive your belt buckle to the wall in front of you, right? Like, you may have to experiment a little bit to find the exact combination of words that works for certain people. But the idea of using some sort of external based cue, even if it's not really there, right? So that's where like a belt buckle is a better coaching cue than squeeze your glutes, because a belt buckle is on the outside and your glutes are on the inside. And it's, again, I for whatever reason, it's easier for people, especially people that don't have, and this is just my observation, right, is that if you work with people who have a high degree of body awareness, and, you know, like high level athletes or just people who are just naturally gifted, you can use a lot of different coaching cues and have success. Like, the, you know, you tell them to squeeze their glutes and they actually know where their glutes are and they can squeeze them and figure that out. But most people don't fall into that category. And so they don't know where their glutes are. What the heck are these glute things? And so telling someone to squeeze their glutes is, you know, doesn't mean anything really to people. And so it can mean a million different things to a million different people. But you tell someone to drive your belt buckle, think about pushing your belt buckle towards the wall in front of you. There's only a few ways to interpret that. And everyone can imagine what it's like to have a belt on and a belt buckle, excuse me, and then put to, you know, they imagine pushing that belt buckle to the wall in front of them. And so it's an easier thing for people to visualize than squeeze your glutes in an external or an internal based cue. And fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, This also has an impact on how you coach mountain biking skills, because at the end of the day, that's all coaching mountain biking skills is. That's all coaching someone how to do an exercise in the gym is. It's all just movement, right? You're teaching someone how to move properly or most efficiently. I don't like that word properly, because that infers that there's only one right way to do it, and that's not necessarily true. Like, people, you know, there's going to be some general guidelines, but you may find that some people execute within those guidelines a little bit differently than others. But as long as they're achieving, you know, efficient movement and getting results, then it's hard to argue with results, right? And so so the point is that some of the coaching cues that we use for coaching bike skills also have this internal base cue. So, you know, things like elbows out, right? Like elbows out, like your elbows are an internal thing. So telling someone to put their elbows out is an external base cue that is not going to be as efficient as finding some sort of external base cue that you can work with them and to get them to focus on. You know, drop your heels is another one that, you know, I don't like that one in general anyways, because your heels should be dropping from them getting weighted from you shifting your weight back, not dropping your heels to shift your weight back, right? Like, the process matters and how you get into a position matters. And so I don't like the idea of dropping the heels in general, but that's another common coaching cue that's an internal based cue, right? Like, is there a better cue that we can use? And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm still working on experimenting and trying to find some things. In the book, he talked about using a method where you put tape on the outside of people to give them some sort of external based cue. So if there's not some sort of easy external based cue that you can give them, especially an analogy, right? Like, drive your belt buckle to the wall. Like, that's an analogy of how you want them to execute the movement. And people learn really well with analogies. That's your best thing. Like, that's really the number one takeaway. If you can have some sort of external analogy based cue, then you're gonna have probably the most success and easiest time in trying to help people learn the movement that you're coaching them on. But in absence of that, you know, what can you do? And so using tape to create an external focus. And so I did a post on body position using this concept where you put tape on the back of your hands and you put tape on the front of your shoulder. And then understand with body position how the relationship between those two things affects, you know, your weight and you know, how your bike is going to perform underneath you. And so that's a way that I've been experimenting with, trying to use this new science, this emerging science behind coaching and learning, and applying it to our sport. And how can we improve how we're coaching people and trying to teach them how to move on and off of their bike. And so again, that podcast on that and the video that I did, if you haven't had a chance to check those out, they're definitely good ones to look at. So moving on from there, I did a post on a injury study. There was a mountain bike injury study that came out in 2017. And so I dug into the study, looked at the numbers, and had a few takeaways from that. And so, one, I found it really interesting that, you don't hear about this stuff. You don't see this stuff anywhere, right? And it really speaks to, this is just kind of a side tangent, but there aren't a whole lot of journalists in mountain biking, right? There's not a whole lot of people who are writing in the mountain bike industry or creating content in the mountain bike industry who are like what you would consider journalists, where you're going to dig into what could be uncomfortable facts and report on them and say, hey man, here's what I found out. Right. And so you just don't, it's pretty much just like industry hype, mouthpieces that you have. And so this is why you don't see this stuff. I did a post on, there was a study that they did on the science of, of going downhill faster. They did a downhill racing study, and I wrote the article. I had it at the time. I was writing a monthly post for Pink Bike, and so that was the post that I put on Pink Bike. So it was on Pink Bike, but it was on Pink Bike because I did the research and posted it first on my site, and then, you know, used it there because I'm like, why is no one else, you know, talking about this? Why is no one else actually looking at what is the science out there and how, what can we take away from this? And so anyways, like I said, it's just a little side rant. I'm sure there's other people out there. And so I don't see them on any of the major media outlets for mountain biking or cycling in general. And I think it's just a disservice to all of us that more people aren't getting exposed to the science behind of what we're doing and some of the things that can impact them. And so this injury study was one of those things. And so again, I highly encourage you to check it out. I got the link to the actual study so you can check it out yourself. But there were a couple of big takeaways that I'll share with you. One was that mountain biking has a higher than average rate of injuries in general and a higher rate of head and spine injuries and overuse injuries in particular. So that those two categories, head and spine and overuse injuries, were particularly higher than average when looking at just, you know, what is the average rate of these things occurring in other sports. And so, you know, that's, you know, there's some things going on there. You know, one of my conclusions is that clipless pedals are contributing to these things, both the overuse injuries because they are encouraging a sit and spin mentality. They're crappy for your feet. They're a terrible platform for your feet, cause all sorts of problems in the kinetic chain. There's no way that all of these things can't lead to more overuse injuries than would be there if more people were using flats and using more of a midfoot position, which alleviates a lot of that stuff. And anyone who says that clipless pedals don't contribute to the likelihood of and the severity of an over the handlebars crash that's going to lead to a head and spine injury, they're just not living in reality, right? Like there's no way that having your feet attached to the pedals and having them not come unattached during a wreck, which does happen, isn't going to contribute to that. And so again, I'm not saying I have a buddy who broke his neck riding flat pedals. Okay, so I'm in no way, shape, or form saying that clipless pedals are the only, like mountain biking in general is dangerous, right? Mountain biking is dangerous. But there are certain pieces of equipment that are going to increase or decrease the likelihood of injury should you wreck. And your pedals are one of those things. And again, anyone who's going to try to argue that clipless pedals compared to flats aren't going to increase the likelihood of an over the handlebar crash and a head and neck injury or the severity of it, again, is not living in reality. Okay. It's just, it's not how it works. So the other takeaway was that downhill riding and bike parks are significantly more dangerous than cross country. And so they dug into specific numbers around injuries related to downhill racing and bike parks and found a much higher rate than average when compared to mountain biking in general and also, you know, disciplines like cross country. And so my takeaway there was that mountain biking is a dangerous sport, right? But what does our industry promote to people? You know, come out to a bike park, rent a bike, hit the trails, right? It is, these people don't have the physical or technical prerequisites to be doing this stuff. And we're lucky that we live in an age where bikes are so goddamn awesome that you can put almost anyone on that thing and point it downhill. And more than likely, it's going to get them down safe. But that's the bike, right? We all know that. The bikes are amazing these days. But, you know, relying on that and encouraging people to get into our sport, especially encouraging them to do it through this avenue first, it's dangerous. It's negligent, I think. And so again, the numbers bear that out, right? Like you are encouraging people who have no business doing this stuff to get into these situations. You're gonna see a much higher rate of injury among people at bike parks because of that. And so I think that our industry at some point needs to, pump the brakes and think about the impacts of growth. But, you know, now we got e-bikes. I mean, that's never going to happen. But at some point we need to just step back and realize, man, the industry does not have our best interests at heart. It does not have new people's best interests at heart. Their interest is to sell bikes and to get as many people into our sport as possible, even if those people have no business in our sport. And I hate to sound like an elitist, but what we do is dangerous. And pretending like it's not, so that you can create this kumbaya, all-inclusive atmosphere, again, I think it's negligent. It's dangerous. And so anyways, again, that's just my opinion, but the numbers seem to bear out something's going on, right? And I know that there's a higher risk when you're doing this stuff, but I also know that, man, you see some people that it's just, oh my God, it's just cringe. It's like, why are they out there? But they're like, you know, hey man, we're outdoorsy people and it's just part of what we do. And I read in, you know, my outdoor magazine that mountain biking is the coolest new thing. And so I'm going to go to my local ski resort and do this bike park thing. Like, yeah, that's what all the cool kids do. And it's like, whoa, man, come on, buddy. This isn't just, you know, riding down a bike path or something like that. It's not going out for like a long ride on a road bike. Like what we do is serious business. And so anyways, I'll get off my soapbox now. But so anyways, injury study and some of my takeaways from it. So there you go. Check that out. The numbers, the actual numbers are really fascinating. You should go just take a look at the post, because I pulled some of those numbers out and shared some of the more significant ones. But like I said, it's pretty interesting looking at that stuff. One of the posts that I did was on my opinion on e-bikes. And, you know, I mentioned e-bikes earlier and it kind of, you know, dovetails into that subject. And you can go, you know, again, I kind of dive into a little bit more, but in general, my point was simply that e-bikes are tough to talk about and get a consensus with people, because it's one of these subjects where you can have someone saying e-bikes, two people say, you know, e-bike, and they're talking about two different things, right? You got one person who's talking about the aging rider or someone who's got an injury, who's able to get out and enjoy riding and, you know, more, or perhaps they wouldn't be able to do it without an e-bike. And that's great. Who would want to take that away from someone, right? Like no one would want to take that away from anyone. But then you've got the rider who's talking about the freaking morons who are out there riding too fast. They are being a bad representative for mountain biking in general. Cause you got to remember, man, like the people who are getting spooked on the trail, the people who are having a bad experience with someone on an e-bike, just out there powering around and, you know, just ruining as many people's day as possible because they got this, pedal assist on this thing. Like they don't know that they're not real mountain bikers. And again, like not to sound elitist, but I think if you're listening to this, most of you would agree that just because you own a mountain bike doesn't make you a mountain biker, right? There is a difference between being a mountain biker, like living, eating, breathing this, what we do, and owning a mountain bike and going out riding every once in a while because it's fun. And, you know, it's just one of the outdoorsy things that you do. And so, but these people don't know that there's a difference, right? All they know is like, hey, someone on a mountain bike is an asshole. And, you know, I had this really bad experience. And so again, you get that in general, but man, the e-bike has made mountain biking so much more accessible to so many more people. And it's a numbers game, right? Like you're going to have a higher number of these people coming into our sport as well. And like, they don't care about trail relations and stuff like that. So you got two people talking about two different things. No one wants to take away the e-bike from the person who's using it for positive purposes. And everyone, I think, would agree that we don't want the guy out there who is ruining it for us and giving all of us a bad name and wouldn't be doing it if he didn't have a pedal assist on that thing, right? Like he's got a little bit of a gut and he doesn't have the fitness to be doing this in the first place, but he can now because he's got this pedal assist. And so he wouldn't be out there if it wasn't for the e-bike. Well, we want to take the e-bike away from that dude, but we want to make sure the second person can have it, right? And that's where this thing gets so contentious. And it's like, okay, well, when you say e-bike, what are you talking about? And I think if more people opened up with that instead of just this automatic knee-jerk reaction to e-bikes, that it would, one, allow us as a community to have a more constructive conversation and allow us to move forward on this subject in a more constructive way. But yeah, it would also just, you know, turn down the heat a little bit on the subject, because, you know, people aren't taking into account, like, man, he may be talking about something different than I am, right? I'm assuming he wants to take this bike away from everyone instead of trying to figure out, well, what is exactly your problem, and vice versa, right? Like, some people, like, they want everyone to have an e-bike, you know, and it's like, well, you know, no, there's people that I think should have it. Like, but what can we do to mitigate one and encourage the other? And yeah, I think it's a conversation that would be positive to have. But anyway, so you can check that out, or you can just listen to what I just said, because I pretty much dove into it there. All right, so wrapping up here, leading into some training and lifestyle stuff that I've started doing over the last couple years, and really the last year, have refined it down. One of the things is breathing and breath work, and I've done several posts over the last year on this subject. So everything from basic breathing, just how should you be breathing on a day-to-day basis, to performance breathing, like how you can use your breathing to drive your performance, to a post I did just a few weeks ago on chemistry and consciousness and how your breathing can affect your blood chemistry and how your blood chemistry is ultimately going to affect your consciousness. And so understanding how these things relate can is helpful. If it's a big part of what I'm doing with my own program, both, you know, off the bike and on the bike, and it's a big part of what I'm doing with people that I'm working with, and it's going to start being a big part of what I am doing moving forward. And so, you know, I've got my first program, the 40 plus MTB Rider program update, that I'm going to be releasing after the first of the year. And in that, it's going to be my first program that has a breathwork section. And so, like, this is how much I believe this is a cornerstone of performance, especially, you know, it really at all ages, but especially as you're getting older, you really need to make sure you're maximizing what you have. And so breathing and breathwork are things that can really, really, really help that out. And so, again, I've got a bunch of different posts. Go back and check those out. Just type in breathing, you know, breath work, and you'll find a bunch of stuff that I've done over the last year. But be looking for more on that over the coming years, right? Because I really feel like this is an untapped area for most mountain bikers, right? Like, we kind of have a peripheral understanding of this stuff in some areas, but I really think that there's a lot of emerging science around especially performance training and breath work, and how to maximize things like CO2 tolerance and using breath holds to increase EPO and the strength of the respiratory muscles. Like, there's all sorts of really interesting emerging science around these things. And so I think it does have a mental impact. You know, breath work and breathing definitely helps. I have a meditation practice that I have and encourage people to do as well. But beyond that, this is becoming more science. And the more science that we have behind how this stuff impacts the brain, how it impacts the body, the more you're going to start hearing about this stuff from the mainstream and you know, general fitness and cycling industry. But it's going to be a while, right? And so I'm hoping to give people a chance to get ahead of the curve and get in on this stuff and start, you know, learning about it and taking advantage of it now, because I do believe this is going to be the future of performance training, and cardio are some of the things that I'm going to be implementing with this new program, you know, starting to put into all the programs that I release and focusing on itself with some workshops and classes and things just focused on breath work and breathing to help people really maximize that aspect. And it's cool because it's not a program, and that you can be doing any workout you want, right? Like, you don't have to be doing one of my workouts to benefit from breathing and breath work. You can apply the principles and the lessons and the things that you're doing to anything that you're doing. And so it really has a huge, broad application for us. And it's something that, you know, impacts you on a daily basis. So anyways, as you can tell, I'm really excited about it because I've had some really good results from it. And then this leads me to the last post that I did that really received a lot of great feedback. And I was pumped to see that because, like I said, I'm really just myself, my own training, my own interests have kind of changed over the last few years. I think part of that has definitely been impacted by the fact that I'm now 46 as of just a couple of days ago. And so, you know, things do change, right? And so there are some things that you need to change with your training and your focus. And so for me, just focusing more on this, you know, 40 plus crowd, realizing like, hey man, we really do need to be doing some things differently. And here's what we can be doing to be able to ride for a lifetime, right? Like, that becomes the goal at a certain point, is not just riding faster tomorrow, but how do I do this for a lifetime? I don't want to be broken down and you know, or not able to perform. And so how do we do that without tearing ourselves up? And so it's really what the focus of that article that I wrote was the two things that I needed to stop doing. And, you know, one was lifting heavy weights to get stronger. Like, I'm really focused on using isometrics to get stronger. You still need to do movement-based strength training, but now you're not doing it to get stronger. So for example, like, I'm doing isometric deadlifts to get my hip hinge stronger. And then I'm doing weighted deadlifts to practice the skill of picking something up off the ground, but I'm not taking my weighted deadlifts to 100% because I'm not trying to use them to get stronger. And so that keeps me from pushing that edge and the envelope that usually results in overuse injuries and too much soreness. And so it's not a matter of not doing movement-based exercises. It's a matter of using isometrics to get stronger, you know, that increase your tension skills, and then use your sport and other movement-based training to have your body apply those basic tension skills to the specific things you want it to do. And so that's been a really big part of my workouts and a huge change in my training philosophy when it comes to how to improve your performance as a rider. And coupled with that was needing to move away from hard intervals and focus more on what I call CO2 tolerance training, or using breath holds with your cardio in order to encourage a high CO2, low oxygen environment. And, you know, just for a short period of time, but that triggers a lot of internal changes that lead to positive benefits. And so one of the primary ones is that the, you know, rising levels of CO2, of carbon dioxide in your blood, are what trigger that breathless, I can't catch my breath feeling. And so regular intervals and regular cardio training doesn't really focus on that. It doesn't create a high enough CO2 environment in order to train your body to get used to a higher CO2 environment and move that baseline up. And so by using the breath hold training, you are driving the CO2 levels up to a point where you can improve that CO2 tolerance, which is going to have a direct impact on your performance on the bike. When you can push harder without triggering that I can't breathe feeling, that's going to be faster, right? You're going to be able to ride longer. Like, all that's going to have a direct impact on your performance. And so again, these are things that are not addressed through traditional cardio training. So using isometrics to get stronger and using breath holds to improve the elements of cardio that you know can really make an impact on the trail are two things that I've had to do to, you know, one, I think that they're better directions in general, but two, they are much easier on the body, right? Isometrics, because you're creating tension without movement, you're not having to deal with friction, and you're not having to deal with momentum. Okay, those are the two things that can, if they get overdone, lead to injuries. And so you're going to be much less sore, take less time to recover. And so it's a much more efficient way, especially for the older rider, to be able to get stronger without putting a crap ton of wear and tear on your joints. And same thing with intervals, right? Like, anyone who's done intervals for a while knows, after a while, you got to push yourself really hard, and that can start to hurt, right? Your joints only can take so much. And so with breath holds, training, because the breath holds are the stress, you're still moving, but you don't have to work nearly as hard to trigger what we want, because the breath holds are the stress, not the work itself. And so again, you're able to achieve better results with less wear and tear on the joints with both of these approaches, which again, I think that would be a great approach if you're at any age. But the truth is you can get away with a lot of crap in your 20s and early to mid 30s. But there's a certain point where it starts to catch up with you. You can't get away with suboptimal training decisions. And so that's where I think this becomes so important for the 40 plus rider, because, you know, if you have been getting away with these other ways of training, which I had been through my 20s and 30s, then you hit this point where you're like, dude, this is not working the same. What is going on here? And being able to make adjustments to help you continue to stay strong and even make progress is super important to make sure that you're able to achieve that riding for a lifetime goal, because your strength is important, right? It doesn't stop being important, especially as you age. It almost gets more important, because you're going to reach a point, no matter who you are, you know, what you do, you're going to start losing strength. You're going to start losing muscle mass. So when you hit that 40 plus age, like, those things become a priority, because Mother Nature is going to start trying to strip it away from you eventually. And so you need to shore it up as best you can and be doing everything you can to try to minimize the rate at which that stuff is dropping. And so you can't stop doing strength training and cardio training when you get older, but you do need to adjust how you're doing it so that you can continue to do it without just beating yourself into the ground. So I talked about that in that article. Again, I know I just, you know, kind of summarized it there, but be sure to check that out. So cool. So that's pretty much it on my list here of articles and topics and things that I went over in the last year that I think really kind of shape the direction that I'm going to be heading for the next foreseeable future, right? Like, talking more about this preparedness aspect, this MTB warrior concept, making sure that riders have a better understanding of these other things that we need to do to make sure that we are, you know, able to be helpful and not a liability in some sort of, you know, situation that requires some skills outside of just riding and changing a tire. Right. And so along with that, the breathing, the isometrics, and the focus on the 40 plus side, as well as always just keeping an eye on the science, trying to bring you guys the latest and greatest there. You know, I know I give it my own little twist, but I try to provide the numbers and the sources so that you can go and check and see, you know, maybe you come to a different conclusion, and that's fine. But I do think it's important to get these things out there when possible. So, but yeah, you'll be seeing a lot more from Bike James in the next year. I'm excited to see where next year takes me. But yeah, it's been fun so far, and hope everyone has a good new year, and I will talk to everyone next year.